After decades covering war and disaster, best-selling author and acclaimed satirist P.J. O'Rourke takes on his scariest subjects yet, business, investment, finance, and the political chicanery behind them in his new book, None of My Business. P.J. began writing funny things in the 1960s for underground newspapers, became editor-in-chief of National Lampoon, and spent 20 years reporting for Rolling Stone and The Atlantic Monthly. He is published in over 40 countries. He's written 16 books on subjects as diverse as politics and cars and etiquette and economics. He is a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And it's a great pleasure to welcome P.J. O'Rourke to the roundtable this morning. P.J., thank you very much for being with us. How are you, sir?
I'm well. I'm never better than when I've got a book finished.
It's nice to have a book finished. Certainly, you have written about economic issues before. What is it about this particular subject of where we are in the business world that you again wanted to focus your attention on?
Well, it's one of those target-rich environments. Economics, like politics, there's always something going on, so you never lack for subject matter. That was certainly part of it. And then part of it, I think, was politics, too. As far as I'm concerned, we're in a crazy talk period. American politics, which I've been covering for, since Hector was a pup, for 45 years or something, has seemingly lost its mind, and I have run out of things to say about it. So I thought I would turn away from politics and look at something that I think people's minds are even more caught up in, which is money.
But the two, and I certainly understand that impulse and wanting to do that, although the two are linked, aren't they?
They certainly are. I mean, I just started out as a humorist, you know, but one of the natural things to make fun of was politics, national and international. And it didn't take me long at looking at politics to realize that underneath politics is self-interest. And self-interest, of course, is the very basis of economics, as Adam Smith pointed out to us some years back.
You make the point in the book that you learned economics by watching people try to kill each other as a war correspondent.
That's very true, right? As, I really hadn't thought much about economics until I became a foreign correspondent in the early 80s. And the kind of foreign correspondent that that I was not a war correspondent, really, but I went to awful places. I reported from some 40 countries, none of them the nice ones. Whenever something bad was going on, rioting, civil disturbance, civil war, real war, whatever was happening, I would go to those places. And this is, you know, back in the day, there was a relatively small group of us that did this. Everything wasn't being, you know, twittered to death. While I was watching people trying to kill each other, it began to, economics was the last thing on my mind. My first war zone was the Civil War in Lebanon, and to me, like, it just looked like the whole place was completely devastated, and the only economic lesson here would have been that war is an unmitigated economic disaster. But looking back on it, I realized that Lebanon, in the midst of this terrible civil war, had an economy. Because otherwise, all the people who weren't dead from the war would have been dead from starvation, that it somehow still managed to function. And in fact, that all the economic principles, that we study in a calm environment, you know, why people buy from Amazon and why they go to Walmart and why they aren't going to Macy's anymore, all that stuff was happening right in front of me, sort of at the point of a gun. And that everybody was in this for something. Some people wanted money out of the war. Power, of course, was the main coin of the realm. But even the good people, the aid workers and the attempted peacemakers and so on, were piling up treasure in heaven. Everybody was looking for some. There was a profit motive was always in play.
It is fascinating because you look at the economics of that, and then the second part of your book is about, I believe, as you call, in addition to the nightmare that is money, there is the horrible thing called banking, or, as you quickly tell us, fractional reserve banking. So how do we get to banking, and what most people realize, or more importantly, I think, as you point out so rightfully in the book, what most of us don't realize about banking?
Which is that there's no money in the bank. I mean, in our heart of hearts, we know better intellectually, but in our heart of hearts, we think of banks as Scrooge McDuck's money vault. And that the bankers, when they get in at 10 in the morning, what they do is they take their clothes off and they dive around in the piles of nickels and dimes.
Yeah.
But there actually is no money in a bank. You give money to the bank, and what the bank does with that money is it immediately gives it to other people. The idea being that they pay you a little bit of rent for your money, and they charge other people, the houses that they mortgage and so on, they charge those people rent to use that same money. And all this would be fine. That would be right out of It's a Beautiful Life. You put your money in, and we put that money to work so that people can buy houses and start businesses and so on. And it would be the simple concept of capitalism, except that it turns out that the bank doesn't actually hold either your money or the debts, that they don't actually hold the loans. They sell the loans. What they do with your money, I have absolutely no idea. And to start a bank doesn't take a bunch of money, because you actually borrow. You have to maintain certain reserves in order to have a bank in case there's a run on the bank. But you can borrow those reserves. And it's all a utterly mysterious transactional void that the more you look into it, the bigger headache you get. And, of course, this is just the tip of the iceberg with the entire financial system. Is that, let us come to the more to the point, which is our money itself. Our money doesn't exist. Our money is imaginary. The government says that a dollar is worth a dollar, and then prints as many dollars as it sees fit. And on it goes. Is cryptocurrency the answer? Well, no. I mean, it seems to be the product of the evil math club with weaponized slide rules from your high school. Once you start thinking about the medium of exchange and the transactions that go on basically in thin air, it's no wonder that people are sort of driven crazy by economics, which is fun for me.
Yes, absolutely. So two points. One is, one of my favorite lines in the book is that you say, in other words, the money that you have deposited in a bank is guaranteed by money that you've loaned the bank, plus money that you've deposited in the bank, which the bank owes you back, plus a parking lot.
Yes, exactly.
So what should our relationship be with it? Should we trust our bank then?
Yes, I mean, the whole thing sort of operates on trust, and if the trust, what happens when the trust evaporates is Venezuela. So we don't want to wish that on ourselves. So we have to go along with this kind of fantasy, but we also have to kind of keep our eyes open. People who were unprepared for the terrible inflationary period, say during the 1970s, got harmed a lot. And of course, there are some people out there. People on old people on fixed incomes, people with very narrow economic means who can't be prepared. The rest of us have to be a little prepared, but that doesn't necessarily mean burying Krugerrands in the yard. But it is important to understand what a delicate fabric the economy is. And it's probably important to keep a small stock of groceries and a marketable skill. I don't have one anymore. I'm a print journalist, so I lack a marketable skill. You know, for years I was a writer. For four decades,
sure,
I was a writer. Now I'm a content provider, and of course the message of the internet is that content is free.
Well, P.J. O'Rourke's new book is None of My Business. But then you went into the very lucrative profession of radio. So good for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that fortune that I make from my, like, twice-yearly appearance on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you know, fortunately that's able to send the kids to college and pay the mortgage on the house.
Very nice. So when you talk about cryptocurrency, as you explain it, though, in the book, it's all sort of monopoly money, and I understand your point about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and the like, although, as you describe it, it's really no more ludicrous than what you just described is happening at our local bank.
That's the amazing thing, is it is silly and insane as cryptocurrency is. It is a sort of minor private sector reflection of what central banking is. And it turns out that the money we use every day, and not only the money that we use, but the money that the Chinese use, that the Europeans use, that the Brits use, all the money in the world is sort of made up in imaginary money. There are a lot of institutions, though, and a sort of inertia and clear marketplaces that keep our ordinary money from acting as insane as it fundamentally is. I mean, it's fiat money. I mean, a variety of different kinds of money. There's commodity money, which is actually something valuable. In North Africa, salt was used as money, hence the term salary. The ancient Aztecs used coca beans as money. We're more familiar with gold and silver. Medieval Norwegians used butter and cod was their money. Their ATMs were a mess. So you have this commodity money is money that's actually valuable in itself. Then there's fiduciary money, which is a piece of paper that promises you that commodity. That's what American money was when we were still on the gold standard. And then there is something called fiat money, which is there because it's there because it's there because it's there. And it's issued by the government on the basis of what I think of as the bad parent theory. That the government issues us our money much the way we bad parents issue orders to our children. In the end, when they challenge us, we says, because we said so. And so the dollar is there and the euro and the renminbi and the pound are all there because the government said so. Fortunately, there's a market in these currencies, so if the pound starts to rapidly lose its value, you can trade pounds for euros, or if the euro starts to go to heck, you can trade them for dollars or for renminbi. Unless you're in a totalitarian system like Venezuela, where you can't get rid of your currency, it's basically illegal to get rid of your currency. Or if you're in trickster land with cryptocurrency, which seems in theory like there are only going to be so many units of it. It's all the transactions are transparent. It's all available out there on the blockchain. You can all see it and trust it. you can trust it if you happen to have a PhD in mathematics, which this old English major does not.
One of the things that is not new about this current presidency, there are a lot of things that are new, you may have noticed, but
there's a novelty factor in play.
One of the things that is not new is that we hear a lot about, when it comes to our economy, about China's impact on our economy. And of course, we've heard a lot about that for a very long time. You and a couple of friends decided that you were going to barnstorm China and learn about this place and its impact ultimately on our economy. You have a chapter in the book called Five Things I Know About China. What did you learn?
Well, I'm a little out of date with my China expertise, and then, of course, I don't think anybody has, including the Chinese, have any China expertise. It's a big place. But, you know, a couple of things that were immediately evident in China. Well, probably the most important thing to keep in mind is this is still a very poor country. I mean, you go to the glittering coastal cities and you think, wow, this is the land of the future, 200-mile-an-hour trains, you know, infinitely tall skyscrapers, building one an hour. cars all over the place, making their own cars. I mean, everything is just, wow. You go, wow. Go even 30 miles outside those cities and you are back in another millennia. I mean, when you go to the little villages in China, with the exception of one electric wire that's running in there, you might as well be in the Tang Dynasty. There's an enormous reserve of poverty in China, which is one of the things that makes their growth look so absolutely explosive. But it's also what keeps their labor costs down, which is why they've taken the unskilled manufacturing and semi-skilled manufacturing away from the United States. That's, if the world is going to become a more prosperous place, and I think we can all agree that, though it has certain drawbacks, that it's better for the world to be a more prosperous place than it is for the world to be a miserable and starving place. We're going to have to face the fact that there are places all over the world where unskilled and semi-skilled jobs can be done quicker and cheaper than they can be done here. And so we have to come up with something to trade for that. And one of the things that we trade for that is our ability to innovate. I mean, it's people talk about how bad the American economy has been in terms of loss of manufacturing jobs. And I grew up in the industrial Middle West, and I know, I grew up in Toledo, Ohio. I know all about what happened to the Rust Belt, and it isn't pretty. But on the other hand, where are the countries that Amazon is coming from? Where, what was the country that Google came from? What's the country that Microsoft came from? Our innovation has been absolutely extraordinary. So we have to trade that innovation for the things that other countries have. And a country like China has an incredible, huge, rather poorly paid workforce. But it's better for them to be poorly paid than it is for them to be starving. Mm. And when we panic about other countries getting rich, the way we seem to be panicking about China getting rich, I talk in the book about what happened with Japan. We were worried back in the 80s, if you remember, we were worried Japan was just absolutely taking over the world.
Right.
And it turned out what they were doing was they were giving us cars and radios and hi-fis and TVs and all this stuff in return for little green pieces of paper. And they thought they were rich, and they used those little green pieces of paper to buy Rockefeller Center, to buy Pebble Beach Golf Course, to buy this huge pack of commercial real estate all across America. And then the tide turned on them, and the real estate went down in value, and we wound up with all that real estate, and we wound up with all their cars and TVs and radios and hi-fi, and we wound up with all the little green pieces of paper. Trading all that stuff for little green pieces of paper turned out to be a great idea. And that's kind of what's going on with China now. They send us an enormous amount of goods, and we send them little green pieces of paper. And, you know, we should take that as a good thing.
You end the book, and I will end our conversation on this, which is with a question of reform or deform. You have some closing thoughts on fixing the government. Is that possible?
No, it's not. I think if we've learned anything over the past 2 or 3 years, it's the possibility, the impossibility of fixing the government. I'm very libertarian. I'm very leery of government power. I mean, I'm not an anarchist. I believe in government. I believe in social structure. But I believe that it should be limited. What I want the government to do is to be on deck to help us with Hurricane Florence when it hits.
Right.
Or since this is taped, after it hit.
Yeah,
it's hard to say. But, you know, whatever the next disaster is going to be. You know, I certainly want our government to provide certain basic services and unity when we need it. And we certainly don't want privatized national defense. But to the extent we allow the government to get involved in our economy, even though it seems like a very good idea for them to be regulating this and regulating that, it raises problems of its own. And the government has enforcement powers that no private company, bad as Facebook might be, it doesn't have police powers. It doesn't have a monopoly of deadly force. And therefore, when we violate Facebook policy, they can't come and, you know, Zuckerberg can't come and arrest us.
Not yet.
And the government can. So be very careful what you wish for with government interference in the economy.
The name of the book, None of My Business. PJ explains money, banking, debt, equity, assets, liabilities, and why he's not rich, and neither are you. The book is published by Grove Atlantic. PJ O'Rourke, it's always a pleasure to have you on this program. I thank you very much for being with us.
And always a pleasure to be on it. I hope you have a good day.
And to you. Thank you very much.
Again, you're very welcome.
Again, the name of the book, None of My Business. It is PJ O'Rourke's latest. It is from Grove Atlantic. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.